and Sylvia. So basically the gist of this is you may be familiar with the idea of Bayesian sensitivity analysis, which is basically where you have a non-identified model and you're going to put some kind of priors over the things that you don't know. And so the problem then is, how do you pick your priors, right? They're really important. So we're trying to think of sort of kind of easy, parsimonious ways of choosing good priors to summarize your belief, particularly when you have a kind of high-dimensional problem. So I'm just going to describe a problem we've been working on for a while. So we're talking about unmeasured confounding, which I would assume most people are familiar with. So the usual way that you deal with unmeasured confounding is to use sensitivity analysis. And the idea of sensitivity analysis is kind of intuitive. You basically just speculate about the things that you don't know, and then study the resulting inferences, and you check to see if there's a kind of robustness of your results. So, and this is also generally part of something called bias modeling, which is getting kind of in vogue in statistics. So you're sort of acknowledging explicitly the limitations of the data that you have. Specifically, what you do in sensitivity analysis is you start with your model and you kind of expand it deliberately to include extra parameters that you could never learn from the data that model your kind of beliefs about, say, hidden confounders, say. And then you just kind of plug in some plausible values from the literature. So you just sort of make it up what you think is going on and then insert that into the analysis as an input. So it's thoroughly kind of Bayesian in a way, right? Because you're putting this sort of subjective information in. And there's different perspectives on how to do sensitivity analysis, which I won't go into. But so just to kind of formalize a little bit about how this works, so here's some notation. Say a Y is a dichotomous outcome like death, X is a dichotomous treatment, C is a vector of covariates like gender and income and so forth. And then let's suppose that we have a collection of unmeasured confounders, like a vector of things. These are the things that you wish you had, so it's like smoking and body mass index and stuff is missing. So basically, if you look out at what's in there in the literature, almost everything that's ever been published involves doing the following. You model the joint distribution of this U and everything else. So you might write a model like this. Like you might model for the distribution of Y and U within levels of treatment and covariates. So make it up. And the reason why we do this is because if you know what this is, then it means that you can recover what you can actually see, which is the observed distribution of Y given X and C, that's the response surface. And you can get that by just integrating over the missing variable. So this is a kind of a latent variable model or approach or a mixture model, because you're basically, you collect your data, you look at the mortality rate, and you view that response, that mortality, as a kind of mixture of people who have this confounder versus don't. And so if you want to do this, you need basically two parts. You need to specify this thing, and you need to specify this. So this is basically the response surface model, right? So it's how mortality varies with measured and unmeasured variables. And then this thing here is this kind of nuisance distribution. It's sort of the, how does this UX, how is it distributed between groups, right? So you need to basically figure out what these things are. So if you look out in the literature, there's a real spectrum of all kinds of methods that have been proposed. And you can kind of think about different things, the sort of number of unmeasured confounders. You could have one, you could have several. And then you can think about your source of information about bias. It can come from a kind of purely Bayesian view from beliefs, or it can come from actual external data. And actually, you can get any combination of this stuff. So, for example, you could have one binary confounder and you could talk about your beliefs. And so this is the most common framework to deal with confounding. There's tons of stuff out there. Another approach is to say one confounder and now you're going to use external data. So this is actually a lot like meta-analysis. So there's a lot of work on so-called two-stage sampling, because what you're doing here is you're actually trying to model several data sets at the same time. You have one data set, you're interested in a parameter, now you're going to bring in other information to kind of augment that. So when I was at Imperial and working with Sarah and Sylvia and so forth, we're on this bias project at Imperial, which is concerned kind of with precisely this, with trying to use several sources of information to really get formal about trying to bring in this information as opposed to just being purely subjective. So that's an active area of research. If you have several unmeasured confounders, then you have a problem. And there's not really anything out there to deal with this. It's it's been really poorly studied. I think one of the main reasons why this has been poorly studied is because it's really difficult to elicit that nuisance distribution for you. So remember I said, like, this is how the methods normally work, and you need to specify these two parts. So you need this thing here. But if u is a vector, I mean, that's going to be, like, almost hopeless to try to figure out what that is, because u could be sort of binary and Gaussian variables that are correlated and stuff. I mean, it's... So now another completely different way to tackle this problem is, I guess, what Robbins has worked on, and also it's described by MacLose, which is to go at it from potential outcomes approach. So to... There's another way to do it, which says, you know what, trying to think about this U is actually just a nuisance. It's so hard to conceptualize that we're going to just, I mean, this is my take home, the stuff that you're doing. It's so hard to conceptualize, we're just going to abandon it and just try to focus instead on the actual parameter that we can estimate versus something that we would want in an idealized experiment and just think about eliciting that kind of distance. So it gets away from, I mean, that has trade-offs, because then you have to try to elicit what this thing is, and that's a hard thing to try to conceptualize, so... And, I mean, it's a hard problem. Okay, so anyway, I've done a lot of work looking at the single case of a binary confounder, so I'll just kind of walk you through a really generic model that's been used before. So, you have this, as I said, you're going to model the joint distribution of the outcome in U within levels of treatment and covariates. You need these two parts. So here they are. So here's just an outcome regression. We're going to put U in the model. And then here's something that talks about how U is distributed within treatment groups. So that's your treatment effect right there, that beta. That lambda is a kind of a bias parameter because it talks about how associated U is with the outcome, right? And then down here, you're talking about how is U distributed within exposure groups, so is it really associated with the exposure? So these are bias parameters as well, and they talk about how strong X is associated with U, right? Because the definition of confounding is that a variable has to be associated with the outcome and associated with the treatment. You need those two arrows, right? So that's one arrow, and that's the other. So this model's been used by various people over the years. And as I said, it's got exactly three bias parameters, right? One, two, three. So the data tell you nothing about the bias. Even if you collected infinite data, you'd never know. Because, U is just missing, so you have no idea if U is a risk factor or not. So what you do is you can go to the literature or wherever to try to guess values of the parameters. So, and the point is that once you know what the parameters are, then you can actually write down the likelihood function for the observed data. So the likelihood function is this thing. It's a product over the observations, and then it integrates over U, because it's that mixture model representation. So, I mean, this is a sort of complicated expression, but it's basically just logistic regression likelihood integrating over that nuisance parameter. And you can just take this thing and you can put the parameters in. So just plug in lambda and gamma, and it's log concave, and you can maximize it and get that MLE with a standard error. And then that is literally bias-corrected estimate. So you start with your original estimate, and then you can kind of... So that's the kind of essence of it. So I'll just quickly describe an example. This is looking at beta blockers, which is a type of cardiovascular medication. I won't even really go into it that much. I mean, basically, it's a fixed treatment study with a binary treatment, binary outcome, and covariates. And this is just fitting a basic regular regression on the covariates. So what we did is there was about 7,000 patients that had... That were being studied, about half of them got beta blockers. So we put the beta blocker in a logistic regression, looking at mortality. And so here's the effect of the beta blocker covariate on mortality, so it looks protective. Here's the effect of gender, so it looks protective, which makes sense because women are less likely to die than men. Age, bigger coefficients relative to one, older people more likely to die. This is sort of reasonable. So we've taken this study, we collected some covariates, we adjusted for them. We have this protective effect, which disagrees with the literature. These are actually very efficacious. But the question is, did we adjust for everything, right? I mean, this is a pharmacoepi study. It's a database study. We're missing all kinds of stuff. So, and in particular, you're really concerned about what's called confounding by indication. which is this thing that happens in drug epidemiology, where basically, physicians are making decisions about whether to prescribe drugs based on how sick a patient is. So if someone is very sick, they may be more likely to get a drug or not, and you have to adjust for all of that. So you really need to think about sort of disease severity. Like, can you really capture how sick this person is in those covariates? And if not, then what you're going to have is this. You're going to have that odds ratio may actually be exaggerated. It's too protective. That 0.72, you could argue that it actually should be a bit bigger, because what's happening here is that it's really just people that are not getting a beta blocker. Like, the people getting beta blockers are very healthy, because that's what happens, and so they're just healthy. That's why they have low mortality. It has nothing to do with the beta blocker. So, a nice candidate for sensitivity analysis. So, okay, so just to summarize, I've given you this overview of adjusted sensitivity analysis. I've described an example, and then I showed you some basic regression. So this is what a typical sensitivity analysis looks like. They present it in this kind of large table. And so you'll sort of have one axis for one bias parameter, another axis for another. Okay, so remember that the original odds ratio was 0.72, right? You remember that was the original one, protective. And so now here we can see the odds ratio kind of shifting around all over the place, depending on as we toggle these inputs, right? So going horizontally, we talk about the association between the unmeasured confounder and mortality. So we can say it's protective or it's harmful. And here we talk about the association between beta blockers and, rather, unmeasured confounder and beta blockers. We can look at it more likely or ever more likely. And so if you look down the middle column, you see how it's always the same, right? Like, this is the same as this, is the same as this, is the same as this. That's because the bias parameter is zero, which is no confounding, right? And so this is also another no confounding case. All right. And then these are these wild cases here. I mean, this is a case that's saying, this is your, now it's 1.5. This is saying, actually, you know what? Beta blockers don't help at all. They're really dangerous. It's 1.5. They kill you, okay? But it's because there's this hidden thing that reduces your odds of death by 1/6, and it happens to be 6 times more common. That's why. So this doesn't mean, this is not realistic, right? And then here you can see. Okay, so the other way to do it is in a Bayesian way. You can throw distributions over this as priors. So here's some kind of priors, very simple. Like, it may be an optimistic prior and a pessimistic prior. So an optimistic one might be, what you can do is just put some kind of mean zero normal distribution on those parameters, and then just control the width. So if it's very wide, like this pessimistic one, then it means you're being really pessimistic. You're like, oh, there's something in there that's, it could cause an odds ratio of 6. You're very, very pessimistic versus a little bit conservative, right? Does that make sense? So it's just kind of, you have this table. Imagine putting a kind of normal distribution over it and then controlling the width. Clearly, like, if you opened up the variance, you would have very pessimistic conclusions. And so when you run that prior through the analysis, here's what you get. I mean, here is the so-called naive analysis, which I showed you before. Here's the Bayesian analysis under a pessimistic prior. And I want to show you is that it's exactly the same. It's just that in this case here, the interval is blown up a lot, which makes sense because you're being conservative. Okay, so now the thing that I'd like to want to talk about is this business of trying to pick these priors, right? So choosing a prior in general is hard, and it introduces a lot of subjectivity in the analysis. And there's a further issue, which is that these models are non-identified, the way Paul talks. So your results are actually very sensitive to this prior. This is not like a normal Bayesian setting where you can just put any prior in and usually the likelihood will swamp it. This is the opposite. So it matters what you put in, okay? Another issue is, what do you do when you have complicated bias scenarios? So what if you had, like, measurement error and a measured confounding? Now you're thinking about this big combination of different biases, and you're going to try to somehow put some distribution over all of this that's coherent. It gets to be a harder and harder exercise. So it would be great if you could somehow think of automatic priors. I don't know if that's possible, but it would be a nice kind of goal. So here's an illustration of one thing that we've been working on, which I think is kind of neat. So this is a sort of illustration of the challenge of this. Almost all sensitivity analysis methods, they assume that there's basically no correlation between the measured and unmeasured confounders. Okay, so they assume that you have some covariates and then you have some U, and it just kind of separate. It's like some genetic variable that has nothing to do with anything. Okay, and the way that that's actually operationalized is written like this. It's saying that basically U is independent of C given X. So they're uncorrelated, right, within treatment groups. And there's been some writing about this. This assumption is actually false always, but it's a reasonable thing to do because it would be really hard to try to model this dependence. Just to show you what I mean, let's just go back for a second here and look at the model. So I remember I wrote down this model, right? You notice that there was no term here, like something missing there, because it depends on C. And the reason why it's missing is because if you put in another term there, you'd need priors on those things, and that would be like literally. If there's 10 variables here, you'd need 10 priors. So you're like, so people just say, you know what, this is too complicated. that's my take on why people assume that. However, the interesting thing is that the epidemiologists have already realized that the shortcomings of this. So this is this guy named Schneeweis, who's a very well known pharmacoepidemiologist. He wrote a review paper in an applied journal of all these methods, and he wrote the following. He says, most techniques assume that the measured and unmeasured variables are independent and may therefore overestimate the amount of bias. To the extent that they are correlated, it means that any residual confounding is actually partially adjusted for. So this is this idea that, like, you know, in reality they may be correlated, and so what it means is that when you... In epidemiology, when we carefully measure and adjust for everything and then stratify, we may actually be controlling for all kinds of other stuff because they're correlated together, right? It's like, and I think that argument kind of makes sense in pharmacoepidemiology because you're thinking of this sort of constellation of risk factors, right? Like they tend to sort of operate together. And so if you get 10 measures of how sick someone is and then condition on them, chances are that any unmeasured sickness is also correlated with that, right? So the conclusion is that this may actually be kind of conservative to do this. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's... And so I'll show you that that's actually the case. So the problem, though, is that, all right, we accept that these correlations should be there, but how are we actually going to put priors on them? So here's what we thought up. We were thinking about this for a while. So it's basically a new modeling strategy. Let's imagine that U, X, and C are all dichotomous. Simple case. Just a bunch of dichotomous variables. What you could do is use a contingency table methods and long linear models to model the joint distribution of that entire kind of covariate process. Okay? So just model the whole thing with a log linear model. So it's basically like a 2 by 2 by 2 by 2 table, right? So a very extended 2 by 2 table. And you could put main effects in, which capture the prevalences of U, X, and C. And then you can put in pairwise interactions, which talk about the dependencies between the variables. And I'll just mention that Paul and Sylvia and I are working on a very closely related method for the continuous covariate case. So why is this kind of convenient? Well, let me just write it out a bit. So here's the log linear model for the covariate. So you're going to make a joint distribution for X, C, and U like this. So basically, this is a log linear model. This is the kind of multinomial representation for a log linear model. So it's got, here's your main effect for X, main effects for C. And then these are all the kind of pairwise interactions between all combinations. This just means like many interactions. So there's vectors of interactions. And so what's appealing about this is that it's well known that if you take a log linear model and condition on X and C, it gets you back to the original model. So this log linear thing actually interfaces perfectly with the original model, but now you can see that there's a term for C in the model, right? So what we've done is we've basically taken the old classic model, attached a log linear model, and when you condition, you get the original model. And so now I said the task is to try to put some priors on this vector. And so what we do is we just model all the interactions as exchangeable. So we basically just take all of the, you have a whole bunch of covariates, just look at all of their dependencies and then just model them all as identically distributed with a common mean and variance that's unknown. So this is the sort of...
I already lost the notation. Does the parameters of the log linear model
The log linear model. So there's gamma x and gamma c. Those are bias parameters basically that talk about how these covariates are related to the outcome. And then there's this rho x and rho c, and those are parameters that talk about how the covariates are related among themselves. So I was going to put in a slide trying to explain why I think this prior is reasonable. I'm just going to skip it. I've been here for a while. Let me just show you what happens when you do this. This is empirically the beta blocker data. This is empirically how those correlations are distributed. Okay, so I won't really go into it, but the point is that if you look in the beta blocker data, you see indeed that actually all of these comorbidities are strongly correlated. You can measure that average level of correlation, and then you can input it into the analysis. And so the interesting thing is that if you do that, so now here are three analyses, final analyses. A naive one, then a Bayesian sensitivity analysis, which does the conventional thing of forcing them to zero, and then one where we make them exchangeable. And so what you can see is there's actually this substantial contraction in the interval that occurs for here versus here. So it's doing that kind of intuitive thing that when you adjust for the covariates that you have, you actually force a kind of adjustment for things that you don't see. And so the consequence is that you end up with less uncertainty. And you can actually, it's kind of neat, if you basically do the analysis again by really playing with these correlations, you can show that if you take those parameters and just force them equal to 1 or 2 or 3 and let it go to infinity, something really big. So here we're looking at a fixed value for those correlations, and we just let it run to infinity. And then here we have the posterior standard deviation for the treatment effect, which is basically just the width of the interval estimate. What you can see is that it basically collapses. And it collapses right down to this dotted line, which is the standard deviation of the naive analysis. So you actually have this weird thing where if you assume that there's infinite correlation between what you observe and what's unmeasured, then that's the same thing as no bias at all, which kind of makes sense. It's like when you adjust, it means that within strata, everyone has the unmeasured confounder. So there's no bias. Or they don't have it, so there's no bias. So, I mean, it's just kind of neat to see it come out. And I think this is maybe an argument for why these Bayesian or probabilistic sensitivity analyses are useful, because if you tried to do this using a table, I don't think you'd ever see this contraction like this, right? Like, you know, so basically we have like 10 or 15 bias parameters. We're thinking about distributions, and it would be really hard to see that on average you end up with less uncertainty. So it's kind of doing what the epidemiologist knew intuitively it would do. So, and just last point about assumptions. So I think the business of sensitivity to the model and priors is kind of a really inevitable problem in Bayesian analysis. And I can think of a lot of things. I mean, there's sensitivity to normality assumptions, to the regression modeling assumptions, sparsity, something I didn't talk about. Those tables are actually really sparse when you start fitting that log-linear model. So how that affects the results is substantial. And then also just your beliefs as well. I mean, there is a lot of kind of belief that's being injected in here as well. It's a kind of a question that has no solution, because I can see that there's sort of, in terms of assessing good model adequacy, there are sort of two issues. One is the adequacy of the marginal model for what we see, which we can study in theory. Then there's the adequacy of the joint model, which we can never study. So, I mean, like this, you know, you could write a lot of theory about this, but it's really difficult to assess. And I think another really delicate issue is actually just trying to understand what exactly is you. Because, you know, when you think about this binary variable, are you talking about a known variable or an unknown confounder? Sometimes people talk about confounders you don't even know about. Do you have one? Do you have several? And so in practice, I mean, I think you're really in a kind of a gray area in here. And so trying to elicit a prior when you're in that gray area is, like, obviously really hard. And I think this is a problem that's actually kind of buried, because what I think a lot of academic statisticians do, and I do this as well, is you just say, well, let's just assume it's binary, and then off we go, right? And you could go ahead and write papers about that. But in practice, like, I mean, I do think that this idea of using the measured variables as a source of uncertainty with bias, I think, can be really compelling in a lot of applications. Because, you know, in pharmacoepi, we know how the confounding is occurring. It's occurring through the perception of the physician, right? He's sitting there, or she's sitting there, and you see this constellation of factors. And you can look at them, you know, you have maybe 20 things that affect their perception, and you see 10 of them. So you do have a handle on how that's distributed, right? So, I mean, I think this is an interesting way to try to pursue the problem. So, and that's it. So, there you go. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, of course, with observational data, there are innumerable more dimensions, right? There's measurement of exposure, compliance, and so forth. I mean, I don't know what to say. I could say I don't look at that problem. That's what people normally say when they get up here. Yeah. Yeah.
And typically, in the studies you're talking about there, though, that patient behavior on the drug is just not recorded anymore. If you're using claim data,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. What you want is patient covariates that you
know
are correlated.
Yeah.
Just again. Yeah. Kind of a bit of a philosophical point is that since the prior is doing a lot of work here, I can have a prior. It's easier for me, at least, to have a prior about the original table you showed, right? Than it is about the last thing you showed. Like I've lost it. I don't know what the third moment of my prior is. I have no idea, right? Like if I think of the original. You know, like say the cornfield smoking thing,
yeah.
Right? And you have twins, Fisher says it's stress. Turns out we did find actually a gene that's correlated with stress and smoking. It's a major science last year. I can start thinking of, okay, what's the cause of stress that's unrelated to genes? It can't be genes, so that gets to the related thing. And, you know, I think their lambda was 6 or 7 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
yeah.
Then almost everyone but Fisher said, ah, it's too big. Right. See, so I could think through that.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe I don't do it that well, but this I can't even. You know what I mean? When the prior is doing business, and this is not just you, lots of people are now putting Bayesian priors to shrink these things.
Yeah.
And the prior doesn't go away. I don't have a prior on that prior.
No.
And I've had an easier time at the beginning.
I it's true. It's, I mean, it's a problem with Bayesian statistics. You know. Maybe I could do this again and put like a Dirichlet prior on it or something, and that might look a little bit more robust. But yeah, I mean, it does a lot of crazy stuff, and they're powerful tools, and it's hard to know what they're doing. Yeah.
I mean, because in some settings it's okay. If it's asymptotically going to be swamped by the likelihood, right?
Yeah, it'll never happen here, though.
Exactly. That's why I'm more worried here. Than
yeah, it's worrisome. Anything else? Okay, great. Thanks.